Hello and welcome to Banfield. We've got breaking news to tell you about this minute. The United States military has launched airstrikes against ISIS, and it is in retaliation for the deadly Kabul airport attacks. CNN is also reporting that the United States Embassy in Kabul has warned Americans to leave the airport immediately. You'll remember the last time that warning went out, it was about 12 hours, and two suicide attacks, two bombers did this. This has United States forces in Kabul on high alert tonight as they continue getting people out. The intelligence reports show that it may not be if, but when the next terrorist attack happens. The five most common words being used today associated with another potential attack: ongoing, acute, specific, credible, and likely. Five words you do not want to hear while trying to evacuate thousands out of that airport. These warnings come as we are all still trying to make sense of the twin suicide bombings outside of Hachkaya, the Kabul airport. They happened yesterday. They killed 13 U.S. service members and they wounded 18 more service members. I am joined now by Michael Isakoff. He is the chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News and the host of Skullduggery and Conspiracy Land podcasts. Rula Jabril is a foreign policy analyst, author, and journalist who is a visiting professor at the University of Miami. And also joining me tonight is Joel Rubin, who's the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Obama administration. He also worked on Afghanistan in the State Department during the Bush administration as a career civil servant. Thank you to all three of you. I want to begin with you first, Rula, if I can. This is pretty striking news. Pardon that verbiage, but airstrikes this quickly after those attacks. We heard the president say yesterday, we are coming for you. I suppose this is what he meant.
Look, this is a humanitarian catastrophe, and this is a byproduct of, this is what failed militarism looked like, unilateralism. And for way too long, the United States thought that they could solve any issue with airstrike after airstrike. I understand this airstrike. Many people understood after 9/11 the urge to go after Al-Qaeda, but the scope of the war on terror in these 20 years, with the inability to build one single democratic institution, makes you understand that our foreign policy so far has failed utterly. And what we're seeing come out of Kabul, I mean, the Taliban, ISIS is basically the rival of the Taliban, and they're fighting the Taliban because they don't want the Taliban to take credit. I mean, we're looking at and Southeast Asia, the Middle East, everywhere we intervene, we destabilize these countries. There's huge radicalization, huge desperation, mass refugee, and rightly so, millions of people who want to leave these countries. And then what do we have? Our allies are no better than the Taliban. If you look at our allies in the region, if you look at Pakistan, you look at Saudi Arabia, MBS, MBZ, who are these people? I mean, when one of the leaders of the Taliban in 2019 asked the West, what is the difference between us and Saudi Arabia? Nobody could answer that question because
Rula, let me just jump in for a moment. I have some additional details. Sorry, I just want to interrupt only because I've got breaking new details on this attack that we've now launched back in Afghanistan. Yes, it is combat again in Afghanistan. CENTCOM is confirming now that this was a drone strike. It was against an Islamic State member, which is obvious because they claimed responsibility for the two suicide bombers that plied their trade yesterday just outside of the Hachkaya gate. We're also being told this happened in Nangarhar province. It's a place I know well. I traveled the road in between Peshawar in Pakistan to Jalalabad in Afghanistan. And this is effectively sort of the area near Jalalabad where this happened. It is believed that he was involved, the person who was struck in planning those attacks. One individual, CENTCOM is saying, is dead and no civilian casualties. It is unclear if, in fact, that one person that was the target taken out was indeed part of the planning of the suicide blasts. As you'll know, part of the attack yesterday was not only only the suicide bombers who pulled their bombs, but also gunmen who opened up afterwards. Quickly, Joel Rubin, I just want to talk to you a little bit about the what this does to the metric of the mission that we are in right now. We're back in combat in Nangarhar province, and then in Kabul, we're still trying to evac, but I assume that if, as Rula very smartly pointed out, ISIS is the enemy of the Taliban, perhaps the Taliban will make this evacuation a little better.
Yeah, Ashley, clearly there's a lot of churn right now underway, and getting the civilians out that the United States has promised to get out, our American citizens, by the August 31st deadline is still the priority. The president has been steadfast in that. We have, as you point out, the airport, major security challenges, threats in an ongoing basis. And I think what we're seeing is tonight a bit of a preview as to what's to come after August 31st in terms of the way the U.S. deals with Afghanistan. The president spoke about over-the-horizon capacity. This is what over-the-horizon capacity looks like, drone strikes. And so clearly we're leaving, we're getting out, it's time to get out. It's deeply disheartening for those of us who've watched this for a number of years to watch how the chaos is unfolding. Ashraf Ghani, the Afghan government, really fled at the last minute, allowed their country to collapse. In many ways, the Biden administration was looking for this government to sustain itself, at least for a while, to see if it could be stable. Well, that collapsed, and with it, our hopes for a withdrawal and a departure that would not have been as chaotic as this one. But certainly, I think operationally, we're looking at a day after we leave type of scenario tonight. We're looking at that potentially being the way the U.S. engages militarily going forward.
Michael Isikoff, weigh in on this. That is quite a banner, the United States launching drone strike on ISIS. We saw those banners with regard to Syria and Iraq. We didn't see them very often with regard to Afghanistan. But is this what you expect? Exactly as Joel just said, this is a preview of what's to come after the 31st.
Absolutely. This is what our engagement with Afghanistan is going to be after next Tuesday. It's going to be drone strikes, special forces operations, and other military operations, not at the scale we've been in, but, you know, to try to make them as pinpoint and retaliatory as is necessary. Look, if the intelligence that you cited at the top of the show is correct, and we are looking at a potential another attack in the next day or so, or before U.S. troops leave, there will almost certainly have to be a drone strike that follows it. The problem is we don't know how effective these drone strikes are. We have no idea who this ISIS planner was and what his connection may or may not have been to the actual bombings the other day. But this is the way our military and intelligence agencies have come to respond to the terrorist threat over the years. And I think, you know, clearly that terror threat is not going away. One of the stunning revelations today was during the Pentagon briefing when Admiral Kirby acknowledged under questioning that as many as thousands of ISIS prisoners who had been at Bagram and another prison that was taken over by the Taliban have been released in just the last few weeks. That is a staggering number of terrorists who have just been let go, who mean us harm and can be fully expected to engage in the kind of strikes that we saw the other day.
I'm just going to double check if this report is accurate, but I think we are getting a second warning to Americans to leave the airport immediately. And I'm just going to say that CNN is putting this report out that the U.S. Embassy has been telling Americans to leave the airport immediately. Rula, this is terror works by terrorizing. Terror works by scaring and advancing a cause and creating action. Whether this drone strike took out the planner or not, the effective action of doing what they did and causing these panic warnings is exactly what ISIS wanted, to completely screw with this evacuation and make the Taliban and the Americans flustered, to say the very least.
I mean, the fact that 20 years after, this is the macabre end of the U.S. war on terror, and the fact that we're still asking the same questions over and again, that means that there's no policy, there's no strategy. We're running after a phenomena that we don't understand yet. And we continue to ignore the root causes of this big phenomena that has been increasing, not decreasing. And in fairness, the only people that can make us understand, with all due respect to every analyst in Washington, D.C., who ever looked at Southeast Asia and the Middle East, the war on terror, through the prism of Washington and New York, and they've been over and again proven wrong. We need to understand that those refugees, that people wonder what to do with them, they might be actually the people who will save us and give us the know-how and the knowledge and the information and the detail and the data about how to fight once we are out of all of that area, once we are out of Afghanistan, once we are left in the hands of, or actually left to the mercy of Pakistan, Qatar, and other people who are talking to the Taliban, whether it's China, Russia, Iran, and we are maybe the people who are what we are wondering if they're national security threat or invaders, or we're, you know, dumping on them all kind of racist rhetoric, those people can actually help us prevent further terrorist attacks, whether in the United States or in any NATO states.
Okay, Joel Rubin, jump in with me on here. The fact that this happened in Nangarhar province, that might not mean a lot to Americans, but the significance of Nangarhar, that is where Jalalabad is located. That is where bin Laden's last stand was. That is where one of bin Laden's most significant training camps was. And that is where he escaped to over the White Mountains to Pakistan from. And now here we are, Americans in that same vicinity, doing a drone strike, not on bin Laden and his camp, the aftermath of which I actually witnessed myself, but on one guy, one ISIS member. Walk me through just the unbelievable reality of this 20 years later.
Well, you're bringing back some memories there. I was very early in my career at the State Department at the time. The Tora Bora offensive took place. And at that time, we were very singularly focused on Afghanistan and really poured in our assets and our resources to try to both A, defeat al-Qaeda and knock out the Taliban, and B, bring some stability to the country and deal with the warring factions and develop a political process, a loya jirga, and a sort of a governance structure to stabilize the country. And then, of course, the neocons and George W. Bush and the team around him decided that it was better to invade Iraq and move our assets and our resources over to invading a country unprovoked, based on a lie. And that really set us in motion to the disaster of the last two decades in terms of our failure to really take a position on Afghanistan that worked. And so to this point of going back in a way 20 years and these individual strikes into the mountains, the difference is that back then we had people allied with us on the ground, Northern Alliance earlier and different groups that were willing to engage and support an ally with us. That clearly is not identical, but there are still rumblings of that interest in Afghanistan in certain parts, but it really is humbling. I think that's the word that comes most to mind to see us in a dynamic that very much reflects the beginning of our military engagement 20 years ago in Afghanistan.
It's so humbling. It's so humbling. And just Michael Isakoff comment on this, that I'm only going to reiterate that, you know, when Joel talks about Tora Bora, I was there when I'm assuming bombers came in. We couldn't see them. It was pitch black. They dropped daisy cutters. The ground shook. I was within 1 mile of this encampment that we witnessed afterwards. It was completely blown to smithereens, several football fields worth. There we were dropping daisy cutters 20 years ago in Tora Bora. And here we are tonight dropping a drone strike against one man, a man they say was an ISIS planner, ISIS K. It just seems all too bizarre that we are running from the Taliban and bombing ISIS at the same time.
Yes, and also I'll also point out that the son of Ahmed Massoud, the Northern Alliance leader who was assassinated on the eve of September 11th, is now back in at Panjshir in the north, forming a resistance to the Taliban. So this war will continue. It will look more like the war that was going on before we engaged 20 years ago, but it is going to be a war. You know, the drone strikes are another indication that, you know, this will be a battlefield for American counterterror officials. And, you know, just remember, in a few weeks, we're going to be commemorating the 20th anniversary of September 11th. And, it's just hard to imagine how that is going to play out, especially for the families of the victims of 9/11, to see as they commemorate that horrible day, the Taliban allies of Al-Qaeda back in power in Afghanistan and ISIS running loose.
It is astounding, to say the very least, all of it. I thought I was coming to air to speak with all three of you about this closing window and the dire circumstances that we're facing and the potential diplomacy we may end up being in with the Taliban, given the circumstance we're in. And then within minutes of going to air, the U.S. launches a drone strike on ISIS in retaliation for the hideous bombing that claimed 13 U.S. service members' lives and somewhere around 170 lives total. It is not lost on anyone across the globe that 170 people are dead, not just the U.S. service members. Michael Isikoff, Rula Jabril, and Joel Rubin, thank you, all three of you, for rolling with this breaking news. We do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, one of history's most infamous assassins may soon walk out of a prison cell for good. After the break, Carrie Kennedy, daughter of Robert F. Kennedy, will join me on today's bombshell parole decision for Sirhan Sirhan, the man who killed her father. Now to a huge story, 53 years in the making, from an era where turmoil slash pain slash division in our society, I dare say, was greater than what we're living through right now. In the spring of 1968, the Vietnam War was at its height. The leader of the nation's civil rights movement had been assassinated, and the younger brother of an assassinated president was himself gunned down while running for president.
Names I haven't mentioned.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible? It could. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. And another man, a Kennedy campaign manager.
If you know nothing of those times at all, you still know the name of Robert F. Kennedy's assassin, Sirhan Sirhan. He was 24 years old, a Jordanian national, when he shot Robert F. Kennedy and five other people in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. All but Kennedy survived. Sirhan Sirhan never denied the guilt and was sentenced to death. But in 1972, California abolished capital punishment, and so he has lived as a prisoner for the past half century plus. And he still may die as a prisoner. But today, for the first time in 16 attempts, Sirhan Sirhan got the decision that he was hoping for from a California parole board. No prosecutor was in the room. They did not appear before the board to oppose this request to be let out. That is also a first in Sirhan's case. And two of Robert F. Kennedy's sons urged the members to grant parole. Others in the family are on record firmly against it. It is not a firmly done deal, however. The final decision rests with California's governor, who is A, facing a recall election in less than a month from now, and B, has called Bobby Kennedy his hero. And now let me welcome my very special guest tonight. Carrie Kennedy is the seventh child and third daughter of Robert F. Kennedy and Ethel Kennedy. Carrie, by my math, I think you were just I think, 8 years old when your dad died. Thank you so much for being here. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this extraordinary development.
Yeah, you know, my all of us in our family and so many friends of my dad and all of us are shocked, horrified, scared, and just really cannot understand how this parole board would let something like this happen. You know, he thought about it in advance. He killed my father in cold blood next to my mother, who was pregnant with my little sister, Rory. There were a gazillion witnesses. You got to stop showing that. You have to stop showing that. You can't have me on and show that film, please.
Well,
stop.
I'll ask the control room to take that down. I apologize.
Yeah, thank you.
I do apologize,
I appreciate
Carrie.
Yeah, I mean, please.
It is. This is raw. I mean, this is extraordinarily raw.
I mean, just think about this. Just think about over 50 years of watching that again and again and again of this forced PTSD. I'm never knowing when you're going to see it. And that, and then they say, it wasn't heinous enough. It didn't rob 11 children enough of their father. It didn't rob our country enough of this great leader who sought only to heal us. And look at what's happened to our country as a result. And then they say, it's okay. Let them go. I don't understand it.
So,
and I can tell you, I'm going to fight this with everything I've got, and so are my siblings.
How does that square with your two siblings, Robert and Douglas, who did not oppose this? I want to know about the dynamics.
I mean,
here.
Listen, Bobby believes that there's a conspiracy theory behind the vaccines. He believes that there's a conspiracy of all the pharmaceutical companies. He believes that there's a conspiracy that disappeared the flight that was lost over Asia. He believes there's a conspiracy theory about my Uncle Jack's death. I mean, just find one and he'll go out and promote it. And he's been banned from Instagram and Facebook and Twitter because of his promoting these absolute untruths again and again and again. So why in the world anyone would take him seriously is just beyond comprehension. And my brother Douglas, I haven't seen his statement, but what I understand, he talked about the importance of compassion and forgiveness and love. And, you know, we're all for compassion and forgiveness and love. But even if you have a puppy that goes into your shoe closet and chews up your shoes, you forgive it. But you don't let him back in the shoe closet. I mean, my gosh.
So Douglas, I'm just getting the reporting myself. Douglas said, I'm overwhelmed just by being able to see Mr. Sirhan face to face. I think I've lived my life both in fear of him and his name in one way or another. And I'm grateful today to see him as a human being worthy of compassion and love. There are still two more levels through which Sirhan must clear in order to actually gain freedom. One is the further review by the full board. This was just a two-person panel. And then, of course, the governor. And when you say you're going to fight this, walk me through the process.
Well, we're trying to figure out that process right now. So this came as a shock to us this evening. And I can't comment on it right now except to say that's exactly what I know. What I've been told is that there's a 17-person board, and then Governor Newsom, you know, he's, I talked to him a few years ago, and he recited from memory about five different speeches of my father's from start to finish. So, and Daddy is really his hero. And I think I'm hopeful that he will be able to see this through the eyes of my family and, frankly, through our country. This isn't just about my family. This is about our entire nation and the world, who lost this great, compassionate, loving, peaceful leader at a time when we needed him most.
The politics of this, Carrie, can't be ignored. The district attorney decided that parole boards should prosecutors should no more be weighing in on parole, that their job should end upon conviction, and that the process after conviction should be who the prisoner is now as opposed to who he was or she was at trial. And for that, the prosecutors were not present. I can imagine that this is a cruel sting for you.
Well, as I said, I think that we're just getting the information tonight and trying to sort through it and determining what the next steps are. But I can tell you, we will be fighting this. And
are you? You know, sorry. Go ahead.
When you lose your dad at such a young age, we were blessed because a lot of people stepped in and a lot of people worked hard to help my mom and to be there for all of us. But there's some things nobody else can do, and it really leaves the work of love undone. And I have nine siblings, nine surviving. So there are nine of us now. There were 11. It's hard to imagine that our family, you know, this has caused untold pain and trauma to each and every one of my siblings, and to my dad's brothers and sisters, to his nieces and nephews, to so many people who loved him, to my mother most especially, to his mother, and his father, and then to my children. I have three daughters who never met their dad.
Carrie, have you had a chance to speak with, I assume, your six other siblings? If there are nine of you and two, Bobby and Douglas, you know, didn't oppose, in fact, supported the parole, that would leave you and six others to commiserate. Have you had a chance to connect with your siblings over this?
Yes. Yes, we have. And we've all agreed that we're going to fight this.
Have you had a chance to talk to Bobby or Douglas?
I haven't spoken to Bobby or Douglas today. I've exchanged some texts.
And how did that exchange, what was the tenor of the exchange, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, you know, look, this is not about my siblings. This is about our country. This is about what the system of justice is in our country. And it's about what happened at the parole board today. So let's focus on that issue and what happens next.
It is slightly astounding, I think, for a lot of our viewers to even think that this was a possibility, given the fact that Sirhan Sirhan was condemned to die for this murder. And but for, you know, overturning the death penalty in California, he was then commuted to life, you know, a life sentence, but not life without the possibility of parole, which is so frequently what the step down from a death penalty is. Why is that? Why was he given life, but not life without the possibility of parole?
You know, I can't answer that. This is just so extraordinarily painful to me and to all of us. It's just not something that I've spent a lot of time focusing on. It's just too hard. And as you pointed out, he was up for parole 16 times. 16 times. You know, people are saying, why didn't more of you guys weigh in? Now, none of us had any idea that this is even vaguely a possibility. I mean, no clue. Who would have thought that after 16 times, oh yeah, you better let them know. You better weigh in. You better show up. If we had known, we would have.
I mean, the astounding thing is for those 16 appearances, he never acknowledged or repented for what he did. He admitted it, but he says he has no memory of it. And there is nothing to indicate in the early reporting at this point that he has repented for it now. All he has said is that he wants peace and that he's a changed man and that he hopes to be deported to Jordan or live with a brother in California. But still, one of the number one, we all know this. You don't need a legal background for this. And I know you're a lawyer. We all know that one of the major tenets of being granted parole is accommodating for what you've done, acknowledging what you've done, contrition, that sort of thing. That didn't happen. From what we're gathering, that didn't happen. And so it's all the more confounding.
Yeah, right. You know, two of the issues they look at, as far as I've learned, and again, just recently, is the heinousness of the crime, the premeditation of the crime. And as the person saw contrition for it, I mean, it's just shocking that he hasn't. It's not that he denies having done it, or maybe he does. I'm frankly not clear on that. I've heard it both ways, but not to say it was terrible, not to say I'm sorry, not to say not to make any reparations. I think that's not what restorative justice is all about.
Yeah, we often refer in my line of work to prosecutors being the advocates of the victims, the lawyers for the victims in these crimes. And those prosecutors were your advocates, and they were not there due to a change in the law in California. I think that's probably going to end up being heavily scrutinized after this.
I don't think it's a law. I think it's a policy by the current DA. So that's a policy that that can be changed.
That will, without question, get a number of sets of eyes on it after this. Carrie, I am so sorry to meet you in this circumstance, and I am so sorry that this has happened to your family. And I hope you'll allow us to follow this process with you as you continue your fight.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Ashley. And good night. Thank you.
Good night. Carrie Kennedy joining us live tonight on this extraordinary news. Sirhan Sirhan, after 16 refusals, 16 different parole hearings, the last one in 2016, 5 years ago, this one, they finally said yes. I want to reiterate, there is still two more steps in this process. Number one, the full parole board has to make its decision as well. It could end there. And then number two, Governor Gavin Newsom, again, who's facing a recall election. He also has to put his imprimatur on it. A man who, as Carrie just said, considered RFK his hero. Continue to watch this space. In the meantime, I want to reiterate another part of our breaking news tonight, and that is that CENTCOM is making a pretty bold declaration about who the United States government just killed in Afghanistan with the drone strike. They're also saying exactly what they think about the person that they killed. All of this in retaliation for that horrendous double set of suicide bombings at HKIA yesterday. Also tonight in our Policing in America segment, we have a very big difference because our friend Deputy James Craigmile is himself an Afghan vet, so this is personal to him. He was sent to Afghanistan in the initial days of Operation Enduring Freedom. He's going to weigh in with his thoughts about where we are with what's happening in these closing window for rescue and what his 20 years, his last 20 years have meant. We have breaking news tonight. CENTCOM is now confirming a successful unmanned drone strike that killed its intended target, a member of ISIS-K, the member, they say, they were looking for, involved in the planning of those attacks. on the airport in Kabul that's come known to all of us, HKIA. No civilian casualties are being reported by CENTCOM at this time, but they are saying that this attack hit its target, that they intended to get one individual, and they got him. Don't have a name yet, but as soon as we have it, you'll have it. You know, for so many military veterans, if they're fortunate enough to make it home, they pursue a career in law enforcement. And that is exactly the case with our good friend, Deputy James Craigmile, who joins us pretty much every weekend for a frank talk on policing in America. But this week, we specifically wanted him here because he also happens to be an Army veteran who served in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. Deputy Craigmile, we usually talk about, you know, events of the week in America, policing in America with you, and we are indeed going to talk about events of the week. But for you and me to start with, I want to talk about this. Look at this. This is the headline from the Daily News today. They will pay, the president said. It's not even 24 hours later, or maybe just within that, and you just heard the breaking news. One of them has indeed paid with his life. One of the people, ISIS-K members, who was believed to be involved in the planning of that horrific attack that killed 170 and 13 of your fellow servicemen, is now dead from a drone strike. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could be summed up was it's about time. You know, this is something that I think that we could have planned and prepared better in the beginning. But you know what? We can't go back and fix the past. All we can do is try to fix the future and try to get our servicemen and women home, get our civilians that are over there home. And I think that we should bring home the local Afghanis that have helped us over the past 20 years. You know, whenever I was over in Afghanistan, it was in 2002. We were the first few troops that went over there. And we made friends with the Afghans over there. We got to know their kids. We got to know their villages and their names, and got to be really engrossed in their culture. And it's a shame to see what's going on. My prayers are going out to the veterans that lost their lives throughout this entire conflict, but here especially in the past few days, because this could have been handled differently.
Yeah, well, listen, I usually call you Craigmile, right? Because, you know, that's you on Live PD, Craigmile. But I'm going to say, James, thank you for your service. And my heart goes out to you as well, because I know that it hurts us to see that news, but it is devastating. It's a sleepless night when you're a service member and you know that 13 of your fellow service members are dead because of a mission they're committed to. I don't want you to go anywhere. It is such a good thing that you became a police officer, because you are a damn good police officer. When we come back after the break, I want you to take a look at this image of a man. Some people say this man was pointing a gun at the police, and then others say he's not facing the police. This did not end well. We're going to break it down. We're going to continue with James Craigmile, Policing in America, with the guys from LIPD is next. With Deputy James Craigmile, and joining us for tonight's edition of Policing in America, where we get the perspective from behind the shield, is Sheriff Mike Chitwood of Volusia County, Florida, and former homicide detective with the NYPD, Dr. Alfred Titus, who is now a criminal justice professor at John Jay College. So he knows a thing or two. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to take you right away to San Diego, where a foot chase with fatal consequences has those who have viewed the body cam really divided. I have to be honest. Some say textbook use of force. Others say, no, a man had given up and was shot in the back by police. So we're going to let you be the judge. What we do know is this. A 22-year-old suspect was believed to have been involved in two shootings just prior to where we pick up the helicopter and the body cam footage. I do want to give out this warning to our viewers, though, that it might be disturbing for some of you to see.
Units are behind them, still running northbound in the parking lot. The fast food restaurant, can't get to any of it now.
So here for the
northbound in the parking lot.
Don't move! Get on the ground!
Get on the ground!
Drop the gun!
Get on the ground!
Drop the gun! Drop the gun! Don't point it at me! Drop the gun! Drop the gun! Drop the gun! Drop the gun!
Okay, so that's how it ended. Sheriff Chitwood, no one out there has the benefit of slowing down and freezing an image and figuring out, okay, what should we do now? And I think for a lot of viewers, they get the news broadcast of it with, you know, perfect 2020 hindsight. And even this isn't perfect 2020 hindsight, but your initial thoughts on what you saw there.
Ashley, you can debate tactics all you want. Back in the early 90s, I chased a guy in a foot chase who opened fire on me, running away, firing from under his arm. And in 2018, as a sheriff, chasing a carjacking suspect, the suspect fired over his shoulder, running away, and struck one of my deputies in the head. You're being chased by a helicopter. You're being chased on foot. You refuse to drop that firearm. If you think for a minute that a law enforcement officer cannot be killed by somebody in that position firing back, you're sadly mistaken.
Yeah, I don't even like to call it Monday morning quarterbacking because this is serious. Man lost his life. So, Dr. Titus, what do you think when you see that video?
Well, I see a very long foot chase with a suspect who has had multiple opportunities to drop his weapon and surrender. When he finally is at the end of where he can run, he is indeed pointing the gun at the officer, and the officer did what needed to be done. Unfortunately, when individuals do not initially surrender to police, the situation can go bad. And although this is not a situation that went bad because the officers saved their own lives, I think it was a good shoot. I don't see a problem here.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and be back right after this. But don't go away because I have just a little bit more policing in America after this. I'm just interrupting our Policing in America to update you on our breaking news that an unmanned airstrike fired tonight in Afghanistan has taken out its intended target, and that is the person, an individual killed, who was the intended target, apparently believed to have been involved in planning those ISIS-K attacks against U.S. service members and civilians on the ground. The spokespeople saying that this is an over-the-horizon counterterrorism operation. Fascinating, in Nangarhar province. That's not far from Tora Bora, right? Remember Tora Bora? That was Bin Laden's last stand. So pretty remarkable. My great thanks to Craig Mile, Titus, and Chitwood for joining us for Policing in America. And thank you to you as well for joining me tonight. Have a great weekend. I'll see you back here on Monday.